The King of Hollywood, The 10 Best Stephen King Film Adaptations by Andrew J. Rausch. Andrew Rausch is a freelance film journalist, author, and celebrity interviewer. He has written two volumes on Stephen King, The Stephen King Movie Quiz Book and The Wit and Wisdom of Stephen King, with a third forthcoming from McFarland & Company. His writing has appeared in the unofficial Stephen King newsletter, Phantasmagoria. He has written several works of fiction, including the collection Death Rattles, which was inspired by and dedicated to Stephen King. He has also worked as a screenwriter, producer, and actor on numerous straight-to-video horror films. I've been a fan of Stephen King's work for more than 30 years. I simultaneously discovered the novel Carrie and the film Cat's Eye when I was a 12-year-old kid living in Podunk, Kansas. The former is great, the latter less so, but they were equally responsible for introducing me to Stephen King. No matter what your belief on the importance or lack thereof of King's cinematic output, especially lackluster fare like that particular film, you cannot deny that the man is equally associated with both literature and film. In fact, to the ever-increasing number of Americans who no longer read books, King is best known for the films. Not everyone has read a King book, but you can't throw a copy of one of his books into a crowded Walmart or McDonald's without striking someone who has seen at least one of the man's many cinematic adaptations. In the early 2000s, I set out to write a quiz book inspired by Stephen Spignesi's The Stephen King Quiz Book, focusing on King's cinematic adaptations. It was then that I, and my co-author R.D. Riley, became aware of just how few quality King films there were. To date, there are more than 60 King features in existence, with somewhere around 20 of them being at least decent. It's fairly easy to come up with 5 or 6 really solid King adaptations, but after that, things become sketchy rather quickly. For his latest tome, my friend and mentor Stephen Spignesi has asked me to write an essay about the 10 King films that I consider the best of the bunch. My background in film history and criticism, coupled with my having written extensively about King, made me ideally suited for such a task. But you know what? Lists are subjective. Also, opinions are like assholes. Everybody's got one. Both of these statements are completely accurate and applicable here, so you are hereby given full permission to take the following assertions with a proverbial grain of salt. I hope to make this essay a little bit different from all those tiresome top 10 lists going around. I'm going to present what I feel are the 10 best King adaptations, but I'm not going to count them down in any real order. The truth is that all of these films are terrific, and it could be argued that many of them are comparable in terms of quality. Because of this, there isn't going to be a definitive number 6 best movie or a number 4 best movie. Having co-written a book entitled The 101 Scariest Movies Ever Made, I'm as guilty as anyone for fashioning these silly lists. But I'm not going to do that here. So, if you believe the 4th and 7th films I mention are equally good, or if you believe they should be arranged in a certain way, feel free to make those adjustments in your head. 1408. A movie on the outer edge of the top 10 tier that managed to pleasantly surprise us is Mikael Hafström's 2007 offering, 1408. The film, adapted from the short story of the same title in Everything's Eventual, was written by Matt Greenberg and then later rewritten by Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski. Much of the adaptation's success is likely the result of Alexander and Karaszewski, the award-winning duo behind such hits as The People vs. Larry Flint, Ed Wood, and Man on the Moon. In lesser hands, 1408 could easily have been just another dead-on-arrival, not-scary, cliched, crappy, special-effects-laden ghost movie. But 1408 soars to unexpected heights. What was sort of a run-of-the-mill, good-but-not-great King story is transformed into something much more powerful here. This is what film adaptations are supposed to be. As good as, if not better, than the original source material. 1408 shows why excuses made for shoddy Dino De Laurentiis adaptations are simply that. Excuses. Just because a story is fairly pedestrian doesn't mean it's destined to be an average to below average film. This is why movies like Graveyard Shift or The Mangler didn't necessarily have to be as terrible as they were. Starring John Cusack and Samuel L. Jackson, Hafström's film effectively produces psychological tension a la Robert Wise's The Haunting, suggesting more than it actually shows. Its deft screenplay and superb direction constantly ratchet up the suspense and dread, making for an unforgettable and haunting thrill ride. Both Cusack and Jackson have since turned in their fair share of phoned-in half-note performances, including another King adaptation, Cell, but here they both do terrific work. The film maintains the feel of King's work, but the filmmakers decided to alter the story's ending. In the original short story, Cusack's character, Mike Enslin, dies in a fire. In the film, however, Enslin survives. Both endings work well in their respective mediums, but Enslin's reprieve effectively serves as a happy and welcome conclusion to an otherwise dark story. The Mist. Another brilliant and, in my opinion, underrated King adaptation is Frank Darabont's The Mist, also released in 2007. The story of a group of strangers who find themselves under siege by mysterious creatures enveloped within a thick mist. The film is, at its heart, about the unseen evil found within everyday people. It's extremely reminiscent of Lord of the Flies in this way. It also makes a strong statement about the nature of religion and how this supposedly beautiful thing can be corrupted, misused, and misinterpreted to hurt and divide people. Darabont is no stranger to the work of King. This being his fourth interpretation of the author's work, I'm including his wonderful short, The Woman in the Room, and here, as usual, he and King's voices sync perfectly. Darabont's direction is terrific, per usual, and the performances by the actors, particularly Thomas Jane, Marcia Gay Harden, and Andre Brower, are pitch perfect. Just as the screenwriters of 1408 had decided to dramatically alter the ending of King's original source material, Darabont conceives a new conclusion here. However, instead of a happier ending, he has written something far more unhappy, creating something that is almost unspeakably dark. For my money, Darabont's ending is about as perfect a conclusion as one can craft. It's perversely dark, but it makes sense in the context of the story. King himself was a fan of Darabont's reimagined ending as well, remarking that horror movies don't need to have Pollyanna endings. He's right, and if you look back at the author's short stories, you'll see that many of his tales have sad, dark, or tragic conclusions. If the film has any flaw worth commenting on, it is, for me, the hideously fake-looking CGI beasts that make a brief cameo beneath the open garage door. But that's not enough to stop the movie from being a powerful one. The Dead Zone. The next movie on this list is David Cronenberg's 1982 offering, The Dead Zone. Based on King's 1979 novel of the same title, screenwriting duties were handled deftly by Jeffrey Boehm. This is somewhat of a surprise, considering the late Boehm's tendency for mediocrity. Funny farm, anyone? After producer Dino De Laurentiis passed on a screenplay by King himself, said to be considerably darker in tone, it was decided that Boehm would excise major portions of the novel's storyline. Cronenberg would seem to be an unlikely director for the psychological thriller, as it's apparent that he doesn't get much of King's work. The director has said unflattering things regarding the quality and tone of the author's original unproduced screenplay, and has also remarked negatively about the lead character's name, which he found insufficient and overly generic. For The Dead Zone to be effective, casting would be key. Cronenberg selected actor Christopher Walken in the lead role as schoolteacher-turned-psychic Johnny Smith. Walken's performances can be all over the map, ranging from the truly great The Deer Hunter to a terrible, painful-to-watch caricature of himself, roughly 75% of his filmography. Thankfully for us as viewers, Cronenberg mines a deliciously multi-layered performance from Walken, who gives one of the best and most memorable turns of his career. One of the major hurdles Cronenberg faced was casting a believable Greg Stilson. He needed an actor at the peak of his powers who could simultaneously display a charming facade with convincing allure, while also exuding a radiating energy that is pure evil. Martin Sheen, who had previously displayed impressive range on films like Apocalypse Now and Badlands, would prove to be casting perfection. Cronenberg displays a confident hand here behind the camera, doing a remarkable job in directing. The pacing stumbles momentarily here and there, but Cronenberg gets top-notch performances from his cast. At the end of the day, whether the director got King or not, he managed to craft an impressive representation of the author's work. Carrie. A discussion of the great King adaptations wouldn't be complete if we didn't mention Carrie, the first King adaptation based on King's first published novel. The film would be helmed by an up-and-coming young filmmaker named Brian De Palma, who had already made a name for himself with stylish films like Sisters and Phantom of the Paradise. De Palma had been introduced to the novel by a mutual friend of he and King, and he immediately gone about obtaining the rights. De Palma then hired first-time scribe Lawrence D. Cohen to adapt the screenplay. Casting is always of the utmost importance in the production of any film, but the selection of the 17-year-old tormented outcast Carrie White had to be precise, as subsequent adaptations have proven. De Palma and casting director Harriet B. Helberg auditioned a number of young ingenues for the role, including Linda Blair and Melanie Griffith, eventually settling on Sissy Spacek. The decision would ultimately prove to be the correct one, as the young actress would deliver a masterful performance that fully embodies the essence of King's tortured character. Beyond Spacek, the entire cast is filled with top-notch performers like John Travolta, Piper Laurie, and Amy Irving. De Palma and Cohen made some alterations to the storyline as it originally appeared in the novel. Chief among those was a newly concocted dream sequence in which the fallen Carrie White reaches out from beyond the grave to grab Sue Snell. The new scene worked extremely well, causing most audience members to scream and or jump in their seats. The film was released to great acclaim and proved to be a major hit for United Artists, becoming one of the highest-grossing films of 1976. Its legacy is unquestionable, as it has become iconic, its haunting pig's blood scene guaranteed to be referenced at primetime from now until infinity. It's also become a Halloween programming staple, alongside films like Halloween and The Exorcist. The Green Mile. The fifth film I have to mention here is another Frank Darabont powerhouse. This one, his second Stephen King prison movie, is The Green Mile. Based on King's 1996 serial novel, the already iconic adaptation hits all the right notes. One big reason, but hardly the only one, that the film succeeds so well is because it's packed to the gills with virtuoso performances. Who will ever forget Tom Hanks' turn as prison officer Paul Edgecombe? Who can forget the late Michael Clark Duncan's ridiculously strong performance as jailhouse Jesus John Coffey? And let's not forget Doug Hutchinson's once-in-a-lifetime performance as sadistic baddie Percy Wetmore. And that's hardly the end of it. Every single performance in this film is spot-on, with more undeniable turns by actors like David Morse, James Cromwell, and Sam Rockwell, just to name a few. You could discuss this film's dynamic performances all day long. The film's running time is a tad long at 189 minutes, but one would be hard-pressed to identify scenes which should have been left on the cutting room floor. Once again, King's writing is filtered through screenwriter-director Frank Darabont, capturing the feel of the author's work in a way that no other filmmaker does. Most of the truly successful film adaptations take significant liberties with the original source material in order to fit the needs of the medium. But with The Green Mile, Darabont has produced one of the most faithful King adaptations to date. That it translates so well is a testament to both King and Darabont, who are creative talents of the highest order. The resulting film was extremely well received by critics and fans alike, and showered with accolades from just about every award-giving organization known to man. It received top honors from groups as varied as the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy and Horror Films, and the People's Choice Awards. Perhaps most impressive, The Green Mile received 4 Academy Award nominations for Best Picture, Best Screenplay, Best Sound Mixing, and Best Supporting Actor for Duncan's unforgettable performance. It. The year 2017 saw an abundance of fresh Stephen King adaptations with The Dark Tower, 1922, Gerald's Game, and It, as well as new television series based on Mr. Mercedes and The Mist. Of all of these films, the one to make the biggest splash was director Andy Muschietti's It. With King's novel having already been adapted once in a mediocre but well-remembered TV miniseries, well-remembered mainly because of Tim Curry, many questioned whether or not a new version of It could work. Most of the concerns centered around Pennywise, and whether or not the new actor playing him would simply mimic Curry's performance. Those concerns would prove to be unfounded, as Muschietti and actor Bill Skarsgård wisely decided to interpret the character in a completely fresh and equally, if not more, impressive way. Like the novel itself, the film excels in its ability to evoke feelings of familiarity and nostalgia. Recreating universal experiences through the use of archetypes is one of King's greatest strengths. The author has always had a unique ability to paint vivid pictures that seem to come straight from our own experiences, be they the relentlessly cruel attacks by cooler-than-thou juvenile delinquent bullies or the innocent, your-mother banters of adolescents who think they're being way more witty and adult than they actually are. King frequently manages to capture the essence of idealized youth similar to a Norman Rockwell painting, but in a way that is decidedly more authentic. Muschietti's film manages to channel the King childhood experience, just as Stand By Me had done. Even more impressive, Muschietti accomplishes this even while taking substantial liberties with King's original source material. The film relocates the novel's events, centered in 1957, to the 1980s. In doing so, the film reveals the universal truths of childhood. Muschietti's adaptation, written by Chase Palmer, Cary Fukunaga, and Gary Dauberman, is sublime in every way imaginable. Another wise deviation from King's novel was the filmmaker's decision to skip the awkward sewer orgy scene, and I would argue that the film is better for it. When I first read the novel, wonderful as it may be, that particular scene sort of stopped me dead, removing me from the action. It felt like a rare King misstep. Am I really reading this? What is happening here? I understand the reasoning for the scene in terms of story, but there are, as the film shows, other ways to convey the same things without pulling the audience's head out of the story. Muschietti and company make many alterations in this adaptation, and they're all pretty effective. The decision to focus the film solely on the childhood portion of King's story was a good one, as the novel in its entirety would be near impossible to adapt into a single feature-length film. Now, hopefully the forthcoming sequel does a good job in translating the material. But the film isn't just effective at recreating childhood scenarios. Like the trans-dimensional evil that is Pennywise, this film has real bite. One reason for this is Skarsgård's decision to completely avoid comparisons to Tim Curry by playing him as a feral, menacing beast. Skarsgård's Pennywise carries with him an aura of genuine danger, There's no sly comedic charm here, but instead a venomous creature whose sole purpose is to ravage and destroy without thought or mercy. Muschietti's skillful direction also works wonders, crafting a genuinely frightening motion picture brimming with tension and suspense. A lot of fright films come and go, many making a momentary mark on the horror landscape, but this one seems destined to hold a firm place in the hearts and minds of genre fans. Misery. The next film we need to discuss is Rob Reiner's 1990 adaptation of King's novel, Misery. This was a novel that King was hesitant to sell the option to, citing the ever-increasing number of poor adaptations of his work. But when Rob Reiner, who had previously helmed the adaptation of King's coming-of-age novella, The Body, as well as Stand By Me, came knocking, the author relented. Reiner quickly established himself as the right man for the job when he solicited Oscar-winning screenwriter William Goldman to adapt the novel. The lead role of romance novelist Paul Sheldon was offered to a bevy of actors, including William Hurt, Robert Redford, and Richard Dreyfuss, but they all turned it down. Actor Warren Beatty was attached to the project for a time, but wound up walking away. James Caan was then cast in the role, which at the time seemed questionable. Although the actor had given flawless performances in films like The Godfather, Brian's Song, and Thief, his best work seemed a full decade behind him. But Caan would ultimately have the last laugh, turning in a convincing performance as the increasingly frustrated captive author. Unfortunately for Caan, however, his inspired performance would be overshadowed by that of his co-star, Kathy Bates. Bates, who had long been an effective but criminally underused talent, absolutely shines as the demented Annie Wilkes, a nurse who claims to be Sheldon's biggest fan, displaying warmth and sincerity in equal measures with menace and cruelty. The actress gives a once-in-a-lifetime performance, the Hannibal Lecter to Caan's Clarice. Bates does it all, showing a full range of emotions that go from a subdued simmer to a full-blown fever-pitched cacophony of fiery rage. As much suspense as Reiner manages to wring out of Goldman's screenplay, it is Bates' ability to make the audience wonder what's beneath the surface that makes Misery genuinely frightening. This film could not possibly have succeeded on the level it does with any other actress in this role. The casting of Bates by Reiner and company is exceptional, and Bates would ultimately win an Academy Award for her work. The supporting players are terrific as well. In a film with a relatively small cast, Misery also features the impressive talents of Richard Farnsworth, Francis Sternhagen, Lauren Bacall, and J.T. Walsh. Frequent Coen Brothers cameraman Barry Sonnenfeld, who would later go on to direct Get Shorty and Men in Black, also does impressive work here. Goldman's screenplay is first rate, and he does a commendable job in adapting King. The Shining. The next Stephen King adaptation is a controversial one, which King himself loathes. Yes, my friends, I'm talking about Stanley Kubrick's 1980 scarefest, The Shining. Widely acknowledged as one of the scariest films ever made, there are a great number of King fans who feel nothing but disdain for it. The story has been well documented by this point, beginning with Kubrick's early in-production boast he was going to make the scariest movie ever made. That absurd statement set the bar ridiculously high right from the get-go, and expectations could not have been higher. Some might argue that Kubrick succeeded in doing what he set out to do, while others refuse to acknowledge the film's effectiveness at all. Is The Shining frightening? If you are a person who is capable of being scared by a movie, then I would say yes, definitely, the film is frightening. Few films in the entire history of the medium, three or four at most, have ever accomplished this as effectively. The film's precisely arranged set pieces, stark visuals, and hauntingly simple score create an unrivaled atmosphere of dread that is so thick one can almost cut it with a knife, or, in this case, an axe. Let me make this clear right now. Anyone who disputes the film's effectiveness is simply an overly dramatic King fan enjoying sour grapes. This is perhaps an understandable reaction when one considers that The Shining is an adaptation in name only. This film is not King's novel. It's just not. It shares the character names and the basic setup of the novel, but that's about it. But that does not diminish the quality or effectiveness of the film itself. This is a great film, and even more to the point, it's a great horror film, whether the Annie Wilkes of King's fanbase acknowledge it as such. Many of King's, and then those fans regurgitating, criticisms of the film are accurate. The two biggest flaws in the film, as I see them, are the casting of Jack Nicholson, and then the casting of Shelley Duvall, and the overall handling of her character. While Jack Nicholson is an undeniably talented performer who does great work here, his casting is questionable. Nicholson, as he does in every picture, comes across as being crazy already. While that quality works for a character like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest's R.P. McMurphy, it's somewhat less perfect here. The entire point of The Shining is the gradual and shocking transformation of Jack Torrance from sane and mostly loving father to crazy-as-shit axe-wielding madman. But with Nicholson, there can be no effective visual breaking point. The problem with Shelley Duvall's casting is that Duvall comes ready-made to be a fragile, pathetic victim. In the novel, the Wendy character comes across as a strong woman and, even more importantly, normal. Nothing about either Jack Nicholson or Shelley Duvall comes across as a normal, everyday person. They are already caricatures before they even speak a word of dialogue. If Nicholson personifies the character of Cuckoo's McMurphy, then it can be said that Duvall equally personifies her Popeye character, Olive Oil. Duvall comes across as a weak and sniveling victim from the start. In casting these performers, Kubrick does himself a bit of a disservice. They're fine, but their pre-established characterizations set unhelpful boundaries and expectations for the story. Despite these minor missteps, The Shining is a great film. Could it be even more effective? Yes, perhaps it could, but it's exceedingly potent as is. Is it a perfect film? No, but then what is? Even Citizen Kane can be said to have minor flaws. If Kane dies alone, how does anyone know that his final utterance is Rosebud? Apologists have since declared that Kane's majordomo was present at his death, but he sure isn't visible in that scene. Again, no matter what anyone says about it, The Shining is widely recognized as a classic film, and its iconic status cannot be disputed. Stand By Me. As I mentioned previously, Misery was Rob Reiner's second stab at adapting Stephen King. His first take on King's work was the 1986 film Stand By Me. Scripted by Bruce A. Evans and Reynold Gideon, the film tells the story of four prepubescent boys who trek through the woods in search of a dead schoolmate's body. Casting is an important part of making any film, but it was perhaps more important here, as it can be extremely difficult finding child actors who are suitably charismatic and possess the talent to carry a motion picture. But Reiner and casting directors Janet Hershenson and Jane Jenkins outdid themselves, managing to cast four astonishingly talented young performers with Will Wheaton, River Phoenix, Corey Feldman, and Jerry O'Connell. In a 2011 NPR interview, Wheaton explained the genius of the casting, stating that each of the four boys was playing a character that was very similar to who they were in real life. The film's supporting cast, which features the likes of Kiefer Sutherland, John Cusack, and Richard Dreyfuss, is also outstanding. Similar to It, Stand By Me successfully captures the nostalgic tone of King's depictions of 1950s childhood, effectively allowing younger viewers to experience what it was like as a young boy coming of age in the summer of 1959. Reiner, Evans, and Gideon, and King before them, manage to capture and bottle the essence of childhood camaraderie when a premium is placed on friendship, and we feel certain we will know these people for the rest of our lives. The writers also treat us to the adult Gordon LaChance's bittersweet and deadly accurate realization that friends come in and out of our lives like busboys in a restaurant. One need not be a boy or to have grown up in a small town in the 1950s or even traveled to see a dead body to relate to these experiences. One needs only to be human. Like all great works of art, that authentic conveyance of universal truths and experiences is the film's grandest achievement. The fact that some of the finest King adaptations aren't in the horror genre is a testament to the author's substantial talent as a writer, not as a horror writer, but simply as a writer. As you know, or you wouldn't be reading a volume like this, the man can flat out write with the best who ever lived. The Shawshank Redemption. Having said that, it should come as no surprise that The Shawshank Redemption, which is straight drama, is pretty much the creme de la creme of the King adaptations. Based on the 1982 Different Seasons novella Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption, the film tells the story of Andy Dufresne, a banker who is wrongly convicted and imprisoned for the murder of his wife and her lover. While King's original novella is high quality and an enjoyable read, it's not one of the author's most memorable works. This is in no way a slight, but rather a testament to the sheer volume of quality work King has produced. It is for this reason that The Shawshank Redemption is the rare cinematic adaptation that surpasses its original source material. The Godfather and American Psycho are other notable examples of this phenomenon. While the film succeeds in pretty much every aspect possible, writer-director Frank Darabont deserves the lion's share of credit for having the vision, talent, and drive to adapt the material in this manner. In Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption, Darabont, who had previously adapted King's short story, The Woman in the Room, had the ability to recognize the immense potential the seemingly mundane story possessed. The casting, as always, is extremely important, but it isn't the primary reason Shawshank succeeds. The film's greatest strength is Darabont's screenwriting, which is far and away the greatest, thus far, of the talented scribe's career. Darabont displays an uncanny knack here for knowing exactly what to excise from the novella, which characters and scenarios to amalgamate, and which new ingredients to add. In doing all of this, Darabont accomplishes what would seem to be impossible. He somehow manages to craft a film that not only captures the feel of King's distinct narrative voice and style, but actually seems to contain more of these things than the original King novella. Darabont amplifies these elements, making Shawshank the ultimate King story. It's more than just an adaptation of one novella, but a sort of stylized celebration of the author's entire oeuvre. The film can be seen as a display of both Darabont and King's greatest strengths, coming together in a duet that is so harmonic it becomes impossible to distinguish one artist's voice from the other. The casting of Morgan Freeman as the character Red is interesting, due to the character actually being an Irishman in the novella. The character's explanation of the nickname Red, "Maybe it's because I'm Irish," then became less of an explanation and more of a joke. Freeman's casting, as unorthodox as it initially seemed, would prove to be inspired, as he would deliver one of the all-time great performances as the man who could get you anything. For the role of Andy Dufresne, Darabont would approach a number of big-name actors, including Tom Cruise, Tom Hanks, Kevin Costner, Gene Hackman, and Robert Duvall, all of whom passed on the project. Darabont eventually settled on Tim Robbins, who was less of a hot commodity at the time. This decision would pay dividends as Robbins turned in a multi-layered performance that displayed great range and precision. Roger Deakins' cinematography is as beautiful as anything you'll ever witness, and composer Thomas Newman's score does a superb job accompanying the film's many already emotional scenes without ever coming across as sappy or overly manipulative. The film was released to rave reviews, but its initial box office returns were disappointing. The Shawshank Redemption ultimately received an astounding 7 Academy Award nominations for Best Picture, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Actor, Freeman, Best Cinematography, Best Editing, Best Sound Mixing, and Best Original Score. The film didn't take home any Oscars. Forrest Gump undeservedly won almost everything that year. But it would eventually gain a massive following, become a television staple, cement its place in pop culture iconography, be named to the American Film Institute's list of the 100 Greatest American Films, and spend many years ranked on the Internet Movie Database, IMDb, as the single best movie ever made. King's film work is very diverse. He has been extremely hands-on, he himself having directed the film Maximum Overdrive and also having written a handful of screenplays. And while none of those particular projects are on this list, his name appears on some truly fantastic films. While the filmmakers who crafted the adaptations play a substantial role in their creation and successes, they could not exist without King creating the stories in the first place. At the end of the day, Stephen King is one of the greatest American literary figures ever to publish, and as these films prove, he has left an indelible mark on the cinematic landscape as well.